July 30, 1960, the Grand Hall in Leopoldville, packed with world leaders, stood transfixed as Patrice Lumumba faced King Baudouin III. He spoke softly, yet with unshakable conviction. He reminded the assembled of years of forced labor, of huts and mansions, of jeers and exhaustion. He declared that Congo's long struggle had been won in blood, tears, and fire, that the new republic would honor the dignity of every Congolese, and that independence was not a gift, but a triumph over humiliation. He dared to challenge the paternal tone of Belgium. The air shifted. That speech marked freedom, but it also wrote a death sentence. By January 1961, Lumumba was martyred, his words echoing across Africa and around the globe. So if you think you've heard it all, you haven't. Hit follow on your favorite platform and leave us a comment, because the next story might just change the way you see everything. Don't miss a single twisted turn. Chapter 1. The Fire Beneath the Words. The sun had just begun to rise over Leopoldville on June 30, 1960. The streets buzzed with anticipation. Children in pressed uniforms lined the boulevards, holding little Congolese flags. Old men gathered at intersections to swap stories of the years gone by, when Belgian officers would ride through these streets with guns slung lazily across their backs, eyes trained on every black body with suspicion. That morning, the people of the Congo were about to witness something unimaginable: independence. In the Palais de la Nation, draped in banners of red, yellow, and green, Belgian officials sat with upright dignity. Their expressions were carefully curated, caught somewhere between condescension and formality. On the opposite side of the aisle, Congolese leaders adjusted their suits, ill-fitting for some, freshly tailored for others, but all bearing the same burden of history. Patrice Emery Lumumba was not on the official list of speakers. His role that day, according to protocol, was ceremonial. King Baudouin of Belgium had already taken the stage, delivering a speech laced with paternalistic praise for King Leopold II, calling colonization a civilizing mission, and urging the Congolese to be grateful. He spoke of progress and roads, hospitals, and railways, built, of course, by Belgium's good graces. The odds don't. They knew he was being transferred to Katanga. They knew what could happen. And they said nothing. Across Africa, outrage exploded. In Ghana, Kwame Nkrumah declared a day of mourning. In Mali and Guinea, protests flooded the streets. In Algeria, rebels used Lumumba's image and propaganda to fuel anti-colonial struggle. The dream he carried didn't die with him. It multiplied. In Europe, students marched. In Harlem, black activists lit candles. In India, Jawaharlal Nehru condemned the silence of the West. And yet, in Congo itself, the news was slow to spread. Mobutu controlled the media. Lumumba's name was scrubbed from newspapers. His supporters were jailed. His family was placed under surveillance. His wife, Pauline, learned of his death through whispers. She had suspected it, of course, but nothing prepares you for the truth. She sat alone that night, holding their baby son, Francois. She had married a man, but she had shared him with a nation. And now she was left with the weight of legacy, and questions. Who truly pulled the trigger? Was it the Katangan soldiers who fired the bullets? The Belgian officers who supervised the scene? The CIA officials who drew the red line? Or was it the world system, the invisible architecture of greed and fear that killed him? The answer is all of them. They each washed their hands, denied involvement, or called it a Congolese affair. But the fingerprints are still there, etched into every file, every memo, every grave. History is written by the survivors. But in the case of Lumumba, the truth leaked through anyway. Because you can kill a man. You can erase his photo, burn his letters, silence his family, but you cannot unring a bell. And the bell that Lumumba rang, the cry of a free Africa, proud and unafraid, still echoes through time. Chapter 5. A Widow in the Revolution. The death of Patrice Lumumba was not the end of a man. It was the beginning of a myth. But for Pauline Lumumba, it was far more personal than that. She was not the widow of a legend. She was the wife of a man who was hunted, humiliated, and murdered while the world watched and whispered. And now she was left alone with four children in a country that had branded her husband a traitor. Pauline never sought the spotlight. She was born in the Itzi's Arrows, modest town of Sankuru province, raised in the rhythm of rural Congo, close to the land, rooted in faith, and prepared for a quiet life. But from the moment she married Patrice Lumumba, everything changed. She knew he was driven. She loved his words even before the world feared them. And during those early years, as he built his political movement and faced prison for his activism, she stood beside him, not as a passive wife, but as a witness and guardian. But now he was gone. The government claimed he had escaped custody, but no one believed it. Mobutu's regime began pushing a new version of history, blaming Lumumba for instability, labeling him a communist, a threat to peace. And still, no official death notice came. No body, no burial, no truth, just silence. Pauline was watched constantly. Soldiers loitered outside her home. Phone calls were monitored. She was told to stay quiet, for her safety and for the safety of her children. But silence was not her path. On February 14, 1961, just weeks after her husband's execution, Pauline Lumumba made a choice that would burn itself into the conscience of a nation. She walked barefoot through the streets of Leopoldville. Dressed in black, with her head wrapped and her children at her side, she made her way to the United Nations headquarters. Behind her marched hundreds, mostly women, mostly barefoot. It was an act of mourning, but also an act of defiance. They chanted Lumumba's name, demanded his body, and called for justice. The world took notice. Photos of Pauline's march made international headlines. The barefoot widow with a calm, resolute face became a symbol of grief and strength. Journalists who had once questioned Lumumba's politics now questioned the silence of the UN, the role of Belgium, the hand of America. Inside Congo, however, the risks grew. Mobutu was consolidating power rapidly. Political opponents disappeared. Public gatherings were banned. Schools and radio stations were used to rewrite the national story. And that story no longer had a place for Lumumba. His supporters were hunted down. His ministers were forced into hiding. Many fled the country, some to Ghana, others to Guinea or the Soviet Union. Pauline had few options. She feared for her life and the lives of her children. With the help of international allies, she eventually escaped to Egypt, where President Nasser granted her asylum. But even in exile, she did not rest. She gave interviews. She joined political gatherings. She called for Lumumba to be remembered not as a rebel, but as a patriot. She worked with anti-colonial leaders around Africa and Europe, planting seeds of resistance and remembrance. The years passed, and Mobutu rebranded Congo into Zaire. Lumumba's name was erased from textbooks. His photographs were banned, but underground, his ideas remained. Students whispered his words. Activists read his speeches by candlelight. Songs were written, murals painted in secret, and Pauline became the keeper of the flame. In the 1970s, while Mobutu wore leopard skin hats and built golden palaces, Pauline lived modestly in exile. She never remarried. She never sought wealth. Her loyalty was not to the memory of power, but to the memory of purpose. And yet, she never saw justice. For decades, no one was held accountable for Lumumba's death. Belgium issued vague statements of regret. The CIA denied direct involvement, though declassified documents told another story. The United Nations washed its hands, But Pauline kept asking, where is his body? She wanted a burial, a grave, a place for her children to mourn their father, for a people to mourn their future. But there was nothing, no coffin, no remains, just an emptiness too vast for words. Still, she endured. And in 2002, over 40 years after his death, the Belgian government finally acknowledged its moral responsibility. A commission was formed, documents were reviewed, testimonies were unearthed, and it was revealed that Lumumba's body had been dissolved in acid, his bones destroyed save for a single tooth kept by a Belgian officer. A tooth. That was all that remained of the man who gave Congo its voice. Pauline did not weep in public. She received the news with the same strength she had always carried, quiet but unwavering. She called once again for proper burial, for truth, for peace not only for herself, but for Congo's soul. In 2014, Pauline Lumumba passed away in Kinshasa. She died in the same country that had tried to erase her husband, yet could never erase her. She left behind children who bore the name of a giant and the spine of their mother. She left behind a legacy not built on speeches or revolutions, but on unwavering dignity. Pauline Lumumba was never elected. She never led a march with a megaphone or held public office, but she walked barefoot through power, and every step she took became a scar on the conscience of those who tried to silence truth with bullets. Chapter 6, The Rise of Mobutu, The Fall of the Dream. The man who rose in the shadow of Patrice Lumumba's fall would go on to rule the Congo for over 3 decades. His name was Joseph Désiré Mobutu, but the world would come to know him as Mobutu Sese Seko, president, strongman, self-styled father of the nation. To his allies, he was a symbol of African stability. To his people, he would become something else entirely. Mobutu had once walked beside Lumumba. In the early days of independence, he had served as the Secretary of State for the New Republic's military, a trusted position. He listened closely, took notes in silence, and learned how power moved in the backrooms, not just the parliaments. But Mobutu was not a dreamer like Lumumba. He was a pragmatist, cold, calculating, patient. And when the world turned against Lumumba, Mobutu did not hesitate to turn with it. Backed by Belgian officers, CIA dollars, and silent nods from Europe, Mobutu staged his first coup in September 1960. He called it neutralization. In truth, it was a betrayal. The first domino in a carefully laid plan to remove the one man who would not be bought. By 1965, after years of political instability, Mobutu staged his second coup, this time against President Kasavubu. There was no bloodshed, no protests. The world watched with relief. At last, they said, the Congo had found a man strong enough to rule. But strength is not the same as wisdom, and rule is not the same as leadership. Mobutu's rise was swift. He consolidated power with military precision. Political opposition was outlawed. The press was silenced. Parliament became a stage prop. And within a few short years, he declared himself president for life. The same offices where Lumumba once spoke of freedom now echoed with propaganda. Mobutu rebranded the nation in his own image. Congo became Zaire. French colonial names were dropped. Western suits were replaced with the
Abacost, a collarless tunic that Mobutu made mandatory for all men in government. Christian names were discouraged. African authenticity was now the law of the land. On the surface, it looked like cultural pride. In reality, it was political theater. Mobutu wore his identity like a costume. But behind the curtain, the same colonial systems remained. Foreign corporations still controlled the mines. Western governments still dictated the terms of trade. And Mobutu, though draped in leopard skin hats and waving nationalist flags, was a willing partner. He played the role the world demanded of African leaders at the time, a strong man who delivered order, no matter the cost. And the cost was staggering. Billions in foreign aid flowed into Zaire. Much of it disappeared into Mobutu's personal accounts. He built mansions in France and Switzerland. He chartered Concorde jets for shopping trips to Europe. He threw lavish state dinners, while hospitals in Kinshasa lacked medicine. All the while, his people suffered. Schools crumbled. Roads collapsed. Salaries went unpaid. Corruption became not just a symptom, but a system. Bribes were expected at every level. Justice was bought and sold like cigarettes. And dissent was a one-way ticket to prison, or worse. But as long as Mobutu kept the Cold War balance intact, the West applauded. Ronald Reagan called him a friend of America. The World Bank kept sending money. Belgium offered military support. France sent advisors. Everyone claimed they wanted African stability. In truth, they wanted African silence. Mobutu gave them both. He ruled through fear and spectacle. He renamed cities. He plastered his face on currency. He forced citizens to recite slogans of loyalty. Children were taught that Mobutu was the father, the son, the source of all that was good. And yet, for all the control, he could never erase one ghost, Patrice Lumumba. The mention of Lumumba's name was forbidden in official spaces. His speeches were banned. His image was blacklisted. But his memory lived underground, in homes, in whispered stories, in the hearts of students and laborers and artists. Lumumba had died young, but in doing so, he became timeless. Mobutu aged in power, and with time, the world changed. The Cold War ended. The West no longer needed Mobutu to contain communism. The aid dried up. The praise vanished. Suddenly, the same leaders who once shook his hand began to call for democracy. But Mobutu had ruled too long, stolen too much, burned too many bridges. When protests erupted in the 1990s, he responded with force, but the spell was broken. By 1997, weakened by illness and abandoned by allies, Mobutu fled the country. He died in exile in Morocco. He left behind a country ravaged by debt, corruption, and conflict. Zaire, once renamed to erase the past, was returned to its rightful name, the Democratic Republic of the Congo. But even in his fall, Mobutu left scars. The institutions he corrupted did not recover easily. The divisions he exploited deepened. The people, long silenced, were slow to find their voice again. And yet, the voice they sought was still there. Lumumba's speeches, once banned, were now studied. His words, once feared, were now sung. The dream had not died. It had waited. Mobutu had risen from betrayal, but Lumumba had risen from truth. And in the end, only one of those legacies would stand the test of time. Chapter 7, The Return of Lumumba. It took 61 years to bring him home. On June 21st, 2022, a single tooth, Patrice Lumumba's last known remains, was returned to the Democratic Republic of the Congo by Belgium. It was small, barely larger than a fingernail, and carried in a polished wooden box lined with velvet. But its weight was immeasurable. It held history, betrayal, memory, and something far greater. Justice, delayed but not denied. The ceremony was held in Brussels. Members of Lumumba's family stood solemnly as Belgian officials, dressed in formal black, offered their apologies. The words were measured. We present to you the mortal remains of Patrice Lumumba. It was a moment heavy with symbolism. After decades of denial, Belgium was finally acknowledging a crime too brutal, too public, too impossible to hide forever. But Lumumba's family had not come for symbolism. They had come for closure. In the decades since his death, Patrice Lumumba had become more than a politician. He was an idea, a warning, a legend. His portrait had hung in revolutionary homes from Accra to
to Havana. His quotes had been etched onto protest signs and whispered through iron bars in prisons.
Africa! He was remembered as the continent's first true martyr of independence, a man who dared to speak truth at the wrong time, in the wrong place, and paid the ultimate price. But for his family, there had been no body, no burial, no place to grieve. Just silence. That silence ended when the small box crossed the Atlantic. It traveled not with military honors, but under the watchful eyes of a nation rediscovering itself. Upon arrival in Kinshasa, thousands gathered. Some cheered, others wept. All stood together beneath the sun, waving flags, carrying posters of the young leader in his signature glasses, fists raised, jaw clenched. He was finally home. The state organized a national funeral, something Lumumba never received in life. His coffin, now containing the tooth, was draped in the Congolese flag and carried through cities and villages. In Kisangani, in Lumumba's home province of Sankuru, people lined the roads with palm leaves, women ululated, children sang freedom songs. For one brief moment, time bent. The dreams of 1960 were resurrected, not by politicians, but by memory. President Felix Tshisekedi declared a national holiday. Schools paused. Radio stations played Lumumba's speeches. And across Africa, leaders sent tributes. Some noted how little had changed. Congo was still rich in minerals, still trapped in foreign debt, still scarred by conflict. But the spirit, the fire Lumumba had tried to light, still burned. At the burial site in Kinshasa, the air was still. Pauline Lumumba had passed away 8 years earlier, but her children stood in her place. Francois, the son Patrice once cradled before being dragged away, now led the family. He wore a quiet expression, one not of revenge, but of endurance. "We forgive, but we do not forget," he said. Behind him stood a marble monument, etched with the words that once sealed his father's fate. "We are not alone. Africa, Asia, and free men everywhere are on our side. History will one day have its say." Their day had come. Lumumba was buried in a memorial site built not just to honor him, but to teach. Inside the mausoleum, walls displayed his speeches. Footage of the 1960 Independence Day played in a quiet loop, his voice clear, defiant, eternal. Young students visited in school uniforms, some holding notebooks, others wide-eyed, hearing his name for the first time not as a rebel, but as a founding father. And across the nation, something shifted. No law was passed, no regime fell, but the return of Lumumba forced Congo to look in the mirror, to remember what it had hoped to become, to ask itself how far it had strayed. His death had been violent and political, but his return was spiritual. It was not about bones. It was about belonging. For decades, Congo's story had been told through its tragedies, civil wars, corruption, foreign exploitation. But Lumumba reminded the world of a different narrative, one of courage, one of hope, one where a young man with nothing but words stood against empires and dared to believe his people could live with dignity. That story could not be dissolved in acid. It could not be erased by propaganda. It could not be stolen by tyrants, because that story had already passed into the bloodstream of a continent. Even today, his voice lives on. In the chants of protesters in Kinshasa, in the classrooms of Bamako, in the murals of Soweto, in every young African who demands more, who questions power, who believes that independence must mean more than flags and ceremonies. In them, Lumumba walks again. So let the world remember, you can kill a man, but you cannot bury truth. Words sat like stones in the throats of many Congolese leaders, but none dared challenge them, except Lumumba. He was only 34, yet he carried the bearing of a man who had lived 1,000 lifetimes of suffering. A former postal clerk, beer salesman, and political prisoner, Lumumba had become the voice of the people, not through bloodline or elite education, but through resistance. As King Baudouin returned to his seat, smiling softly, the room expected a polite reply from Prime Minister Joseph Kasavubu. But Lumumba rose. At first, the hall fell into polite applause. Some assumed he would speak briefly, perhaps offer words of thanks. Instead, he stepped to the podium and unfolded a speech he had written in secret with his closest aides the night before. It was a declaration, not of gratitude, but of fire. He began, "No Congolese worthy of the name will ever be able to forget that independence was won in struggle, a struggle in which we were spared neither suffering nor hardship, and for which we gave our strength and our blood." The air changed. Gasps and whispers rippled through the Belgian delegation. Cameras flashed. Journalists looked up from their notes. Lumumba didn't stop. "We have known ironies, insults, beatings. We have known that the law was never the same for a white man and a black man." His voice trembled, not with fear, but with emotion. He spoke for every rubber tapper maimed in the forest, for every mother who watched her son beaten for standing too tall, for every worker who was told to be grateful for chains dressed as wages. Belgian faces turned cold. Some of the Congolese ministers, stunned, fidgeted in their chairs. Kasavubu stared down at the table. The moment was unprecedented, unscripted, unforgivable. But Lumumba had tapped into something deeper than politics. The room was filled with ghosts, the ghosts of millions of Congolese who had perished under Belgium's rule. And through him, those voices finally screamed. Outside the Palais, the speech was being broadcast through crackling loudspeakers. Crowds that had gathered in the heat stood motionless. Children clutched their mothers. Elders wept. For the first time in public memory, someone had told the truth aloud. In Western capitals, the reaction was swift. That evening,
Belgian diplomats sent telegrams to Brussels marked urgent. Lumumba's defiance was seen not just as offensive, but dangerous. In Washington, D.C., officials in the Eisenhower administration took notice. Congo was too rich, too strategic, too vital to the Cold War chessboard to be handed over to a man they now viewed as unpredictable and possibly aligned with the Soviet Union. But to Lumumba, this was not about geopolitics. This was about dignity, about narrative, about who got to tell the story of the Congo. He had torn up the script. Back at the independence reception, King Baudouin's face froze into a tight smile. Lumumba's words had humiliated the monarchy in front of the world. The king said nothing, but in quiet rooms behind thick doors, conversations began about damage control, about containment, and about removal. In the weeks that followed, the CIA, Belgian intelligence, and local Congolese factions began laying plans. Rumors of communist sympathy were exaggerated. His efforts to nationalize mines, dismissed as anti-capitalist, his grassroots popularity, redefined as demagoguery. But none of it would have begun, not so quickly, not with such intensity, had he not made that speech. The words were not just a declaration. They were a lit match dropped into a room full of gasoline. And once spoken, they could never be taken back. Chapter 2. Enemies in Every Direction. The morning after the independence ceremony, Leopoldville was divided. On one side were the streets, the people. They danced to the rhythm of Lumumba's words. Radios replayed his speech on a loop. In markets and churches, elders declared it the moment the Congo had truly become free. But inside the new halls of power, and in the corridors of embassies, another tone was setting in. One of fear, calculation, and strategy. Patrice Lumumba had spoken truth. But in politics, especially in the Cold War era, truth without obedience was dangerous.
To Washington, Lumumba was no longer a proud African leader. He was a problem. CIA analysts filed immediate reports to the White House. They questioned his leanings, his alliances, his influence. He had spoken the language of liberation, but to the West, that sounded an awful lot like communism. And in 1960, that was a death sentence. Inside CIA headquarters, Congo was suddenly on the front burner. The newly independent nation was larger than Western Europe and rich with resources, especially uranium, which had been used to build the atomic bomb. If Lumumba couldn't be trusted, he had to be neutralized, quietly, permanently. Meanwhile, Belgium wasn't willing to let go either. Officially, they had granted independence. But in reality, they had left behind a fractured system. The military was still led by Belgian officers. The economy was dominated by Belgian corporations. The state apparatus was barely Congolese at all, and Lumumba's speech had insulted them publicly. So Belgium began to act. They supported secessionist leaders in mineral-rich Katanga province, led by a polished and ambitious man named Moïse Tshombe. Katanga declared itself independent less than 2 weeks after Congo's own independence. It was not a coincidence. Tshombe was backed with Belgian money, Belgian arms, and Belgian political advisors. And just like that, Lumumba's new nation was already falling apart. Internally, the cabinet was crumbling too. Lumumba's relationship with President Joseph Kasavubu began to deteriorate. The two men had different styles. Kasavubu was conservative and diplomatic, careful not to offend Western powers. Lumumba was defiant, unapologetic, driven by the belief that colonizers had no right to lecture their former slaves on order and stability. That made Lumumba powerful among the people and deeply threatening to everyone else. He tried to assert control over the military, renaming it the Armée Nationale Congolaise and replacing white officers with black ones. But this backfired. The force descended into chaos. Riots broke out. Belgian troops re-entered under the pretense of restoring order. White settlers were evacuated. International headlines screamed Congo in crisis. In reality, it was sabotage. To the public, Lumumba looked like he had lost control. To his enemies, it was the perfect storm. The United Nations sent peacekeeping forces. Lumumba hoped they would help restore sovereignty, but the UN, fearing escalation, refused to use force to expel Belgian-backed secessionists in Katanga. Lumumba was furious. He had asked for help to protect his country's unity. Instead, he received bureaucracy and neutrality. Cornered, Lumumba made a fatal decision. He reached out to the Soviet Union. He sent a request for planes, weapons, and technical assistance. That was it. The West's fears were confirmed. Whether he was a true communist or not didn't matter. The perception was enough. In the eyes of Washington, Lumumba had officially joined the wrong side of the Cold War. The CIA's Congo station chief cabled back to headquarters, "The removal of Lumumba must be an urgent and prime objective." They weren't alone. Mobutu Sese Seko, Lumumba's former ally and now Army Chief of Staff, began to act. He was young, ambitious, and had the backing of both American and Belgian agents. He positioned himself as the moderate African, someone the West could trust. He met secretly with CIA operatives. Promises were made. And on September 14th, just 2.5 months after the independence celebrations, Mobutu staged a bloodless coup. The radio announced that both Prime Minister Lumumba and President Kasavubu were temporarily suspended. It was the beginning of the end. Lumumba was placed under house arrest. His every movement was watched. His allies were harassed, arrested, or silenced. And yet, he still commanded the love of the people. He still had letters being smuggled out. His voice still carried weight. That made him even more dangerous. From jail, he wrote, "We are not alone. Africa, Asia, and free men everywhere are on our side. History will one day have its say. But history was being rewritten in real time. Western newspapers branded him a fanatic, a destabilizer, a dictator in the making. Inside Congo, propaganda worked its way into the airwaves. Soldiers were paid off. Officers were flipped. The revolution Lumumba dreamed of was slowly being smothered by shadows. And everywhere he turned, Belgium, the United States, the United Nations, even some of his fellow Congolese, he found no allies, only enemies with painted smiles. But Patrice Lumumba was not done yet. One night in late November, he slipped past the guards of his residence with two loyal aides. Disguised and determined, he made a desperate attempt to reach Stanleyville, where his supporters still held ground. His plan was to reorganize the government, retake the capital, and finish what he started. But the arts, yaut, jungle roads of the Congo were long, and enemies were watching. His fate, sealed by words spoken in dignity, was now tied to a race for survival. Chapter 3. The Capture. The skies above the Congo were heavy with rain the morning Patrice Lumumba disappeared from his residence. The roads were mud, thick and slow, but he pressed forward. With him were two trusted allies, Joseph Okito and Maurice Mpolo, men who knew the risk and still chose loyalty. Their destination was Stanleyville, hundreds of miles away, where Lumumba's supporters still held power and hope. His escape was a last gamble. He believed that if he could reach Stanleyville, he could rally the people, regroup the government, and expose Mobutu's coup for what it was, a foreign-sponsored betrayal. The idea of surrendering was never part of Lumumba's language. He was a man built for resistance. Even with the CIA, the Belgians, and Mobutu circling like vultures, he still believed in the possibility of freedom. But this wasn't a war of ideas anymore. It was a manhunt. Mobutu's intelligence network, aided by Belgian and American surveillance, knew where to look. Villagers were interrogated. Roadblocks were quietly placed. Lumumba's convoy had no air cover, no secure communications, and no support. On the third day, just as they approached the Sankuru River near the town of Port Franqui, the group was spotted by a local military patrol. Lumumba was instantly recognized. The young soldiers, many of whom once saluted him as the father of the nation, were now under orders from Mobutu. They arrested him on sight, rifles pointed, nervous fingers on triggers. Lumumba stood tall, even as they tied his hands behind his back. "Do what you must," he told them. "History is watching." He was taken back to Leopoldville, bruised but unbowed. Crowds lined the streets in shock and silence as soldiers paraded him through town like a captured animal. The images were humiliating. His shirt torn, his face bloodied, his hair disheveled. A calculated public spectacle. Photographs of Lumumba, bound and beaten, spread across the world. The message was clear. The revolution had been crushed. But for the West, even that wasn't enough. He had to disappear. Behind closed doors, discussions began. The CIA inquired about options. One, Cable suggested quietly poisoning his food. Another floated the idea of disposal. But the Americans were not the only ones planning. Belgian officials, who still held influence in the military, saw an opportunity to end the Lumumba problem permanently. The final decision wasn't made in a courtroom or a parliament. It was made in the shadows, between Mobutu's new regime, Katangan secessionists, and Belgian agents who wanted revenge. Lumumba was moved from Leopoldville to Thysville prison, deeper inland. There, guards were rotated frequently. His food was tasted by others. He wrote letters in secret, smuggled out by guards who sympathized. In one of his final notes to his wife, Pauline, he said, "I want my children to be proud of being Congolese, to love their country, and to serve it with honesty and dignity." But time was running out. In January 1961, a decision was made to transfer him to Katanga, the breakaway province ruled by Moise Tshombe. It was a death sentence disguised as a logistical move. Mobutu's regime claimed they could no longer guarantee Lumumba's safety in central Congo. But no one believed that. Tshombe had called Lumumba a traitor, and Katanga was where Belgian advisors operated most freely. The day of the transfer, Lumumba was dragged from his cell in the early morning hours. His hands were tied once again, and he was shoved into a military plane along with Impolo and Okito. The aircraft rumbled across the Congo sky under a curtain of silence. When they landed in Elizabethville, the Katangan capital, a group of men waited. Soldiers, police, and Belgian officers. Lumumba was immediately taken to a secluded house. He was interrogated, beaten, and insulted for hours. That night, he was driven to a clearing in the bush outside the city. There were no cameras now, no microphones, no applause or outrage, just cold air, gunfire, and silence. Patrice Lumumba was executed by firing squad, along with Joseph Okito and Maurice Impolo. But even in death, the conspirators feared his power. His body was buried, then exhumed, dismembered, dissolved in acid. The Belgians who helped oversee the process wanted no grave, no monument, no place where followers could gather, only disappearance. But what they didn't understand was that Lumumba's power had never come from visibility. It came from truth, from sacrifice, from the unrelenting voice of someone who believed in a future beyond fear. And even though his voice had been silenced, his words had already taken root. In Algeria, young revolutionaries quoted him. In South Africa, Mandela called him a brother. In Harlem, protesters painted his name on placards. And in every colonized nation rising toward freedom, the story of Lumumba became more than a tragedy. It became a blueprint. The Congo, meanwhile, spiraled. Mobutu would later consolidate power, ruling with an iron fist for more than 3 decades. The West, satisfied with the stability, turned a blind eye to repression, corruption, and decline. But those images, Lumumba bloodied, hands tied, eyes unbroken, remained. He had walked toward death without flinching. He had chosen dignity over compromise. And his enemies, despite their power, had only proven his point. They feared not his army, not his weapons, not his government. They feared his words. Chapter 4. The Blood on Everyone's Hands. The murder of Patrice Lumumba didn't just stain the soil of Katanga. It bled across boardrooms, embassies, and intelligence offices around the world. His death wasn't an accident of history. It was an orchestrated execution, spread out over months, signed in silence by powerful hands. And those hands were everywhere. In Washington, D.C., the CIA filed the event under classified reports, tucked behind euphemisms like regime stabilization and foreign assets secured. But those inside the agency knew the truth. As early as August 1960, the CIA's Congo station had been ordered to eliminate Lumumba. A poison plan had been floated, dental cream laced with toxins, to be smuggled into his toiletries. It never materialized, but the will was there. President Eisenhower had, according to one source, personally authorized the removal. Not in blunt terms, never that. But the message was clear. Lumumba could not be allowed to align with the Soviets. Congo was too important. The uranium used in the Hiroshima bomb had come from its mines. The Cold War chessboard would not tolerate such a wild card. So, instead of assassination by hand, it was done by proxy. Belgian officials, deeply wounded by Lumumba's Independence Day speech, had been pushing for his elimination even harder. While the CIA hesitated, Belgium acted. Belgian officers were present at every step of Lumumba's final days, his transfer to Katanga, his torture, and his execution. Years later, a Belgian policeman named Gerard Soete admitted to helping dismember Lumumba's body and dissolve it in sulfuric acid. He even kept two of Lumumba's teeth as souvenirs. That grotesque confession, released decades later, forced the Belgian government to finally admit moral responsibility for Lumumba's death. But by then, it was too late. Back in Africa, Mobutu sat comfortably in power. He had played the perfect role, the ambitious African who obeyed Western expectations. He spoke French fluently, wore polished boots, and denounced communism. For the United States and Belgium, he was the ideal leader, predictable, ruthless, and most importantly, willing to keep foreign capital flowing. Mobutu would go on to receive billions in aid from the West. In return, he handed over Congolese resources with a handshake. Gold, diamonds, copper, cobalt, the wealth of a nation funneled into foreign vaults while his people starved. But the international community never blamed him. They blamed Lumumba for the chaos. They called him reckless, inflammatory, naive. But what they truly feared was not his behavior. It was his clarity. Lumumba didn't play games. He didn't dance between allegiances. He said, again and again, that Congo belonged to the Congolese, that no empire, East or West, had the right to rule his people. That kind of clarity is dangerous in a world built on compromise and control. And then there was the United Nations. Their peacekeepers were already in the Congo when Lumumba was arrested. He had begged them for protection. He even offered to place Congo's military under UN supervision if they would just help preserve national unity and stop the Katangan secession. But the UN did nothing. Secretary General Dag Hammarskjöld said their role was neutral. They couldn't interfere in internal affairs. But neutrality, in this case, meant standing still while Lumumba was hunted. The silence of the UN became complicity. When Lumumba was executed, the UN denied prior knowledge, but cables later revealed that high-ranking officials were warned ahead of time.